Hello and welcome to the Beyond podcast and to this episode of the Fantasy Production Meeting, where we build the productions we want to see as a down payment to the future. I'm Robert, just returned from my nunchions in Lavenham, and I like nunching so much I like to do it twice.
I am Tamara. This is Sammy, not that you will be able to see the cat in my lap, but he's here with me. And I like nunching because it sounds like a place in Middle-earth, and specifically the Shire.
I'm Alexandra, and I like nunching for its historical architecture and its Chinese opera traditions.
And I'm Liza in London, and I'm really not sure about nunching as a verb, especially a transitive verb. Just sounds like something you do with nuns.
And we are the Fantasy Production team, and this is our meeting today. We're looking at Thomas Cromwell, a play with no firmly ascribable author or playing company from the early 17th century. But dating and company, they don't worry us here. We are not concerned. We're only interested in how we might want to produce this play today to help us decide which version we might like to pursue. We have a special guest from our online exploring group who the pitchers will try to impress and win over to their side with bribes or with wit. So, in the not exactly hot seat, more moderately warm going on, it's more not so much warmed up, as just, I mean, the kind of warmth you get from squatting over a toaster, that's sort of the sort of warmth we're going for here, is...
Hi, I'm Eric. I don't know what nunching is, and it was quite, it is warm. I mean, I'm sitting on a leather seat, and it's quite like, you know, it's been 38 degrees, so...
Nice. We're all need to convince, I don't need to convince anyone. You need to convince Eric. If you, however, at home are inspired by our ideas or would like to keep us in cheese, then you can support our work generally on Patreon, patreon.com/beyondshakespeare, where you can hear the uncut version of this episode. You can hear it early. You can even watch the video. We're doing video things now that are really exciting. Depending on how much you pledge, you will get these exciting bonus things, as well as other bonus patron content, patron-only content, and early access stuff as well. But that's enough of that. Nobody likes those sort of bits. They're really boring and tedious. So let's get down to business. We've got a production to build.
But Rob, what's the play about?
I'm glad you asked that question. Thomas Lord Cromwell isn't Wolf Hall.
Aww.
It's much more fun. Young Thomas lives with his forward-thinking father, who wants his son to be upwardly mobile. Having gained an education, he gets a post in Antwerp, where he stops the evil Bagot...
Boo hiss!
...from ruining the fortunes of the delightful merchant Bannister and his wife.
Yay!
He then goes interrailing across Europe with his servant, the redoubtable Hodge.
Who likes his nunchings.
They are robbed on the road.
Ooh, hiss!
But are saved by the delightful Friskyball.
Yay!
Who pays their way forward. They then rescue the noble Bedford from imprisonment in Bologna.
Double yay!
Before returning to England, where he rises through the ranks thanks to Cardinal Wolsey.
Triple yay!
Who dies.
Aww.
But he still rises to become the keeper of the Privy Seal. And he helps the now destitute Friskyball.
Yay again!
His father and all the other characters this semi-prodigal son has encountered in his life.
And everyone lives happily ever after.
Until following a fatal error in not reading letters in his in tray, Thomas Cromwell is committed for treason by Gardiner and is imprisoned and executed.
Aww.
The end. So it's a personal history play that makes a whole series of amazing choices about how to tell this story. Basically, I love this play, but how to produce it? So let us go to the Fantasy Production Meeting whiteboard and crack on. So, first question. Briefly, each person is going to get to say what, broadly speaking, what their budget, what their venue, what their medium is going to be. So we're going to see which medium they drew out of the Fantasy Production Meeting hat to see what they're going to go with. So Liza, first, what sort of production are you going to be pitching?
Well, my brief was installation slash artwork. And what I've done is created a game which can run either virtually or in real space.
Ooh, liking it, liking it.
If this happens in real time, pestilence permitting, my ideal setting would be Hampton Court Palace because of its historical connection to Henry VIII and to Cromwell. I could also, if given another venue, I could transform it into Hampton Court Palace. Or the whole thing could take place in virtual reality. I've been seeing some amazing virtual reality software which will allow you to superimpose live performance on a piece of 3D art. And what I would do, because this is a fantasy and we all have infinity money, is get someone to do a 3D rendering of Hans Holbein's The Ambassadors. At Hampton Court, you'd have to recreate it using practicals, which, knowing me, I'd probably make them out of cardboard. But online, you know, you can make a 3D rendering of the painting and you can, like, slip into it. For those who haven't seen Hans Holbein's The Ambassadors, it's two middle-aged men, sort of white guys with beards, but not, they're middle-aged men of what look like upper-middle-class status, but not nobility. See, I forget who they actually are, but the implication is that these guys are ambassadors and they're well-traveled, and the painting is this, it's basically a room with these two guys and all of these, of their possessions, which are painted so clearly. There's a beautiful lute, and you can tell, you can count its strings, and there's a piece of sheet music next to it, and the music is so clearly painted, you can read it. And it's got, you know, all kinds of beautiful things in this room. And there's a globe, there are maps, everything is sort of a metaphor for the journeys and travel and life and the things you encounter. And then if you stand in the corner by the painting, you sort of look at the floor in an angular way, what looks like a gray smear on the floor coalesces into a skull. So even though these guys are successful and surrounded by worldly possessions, death is present in the room. So for me, that's this play. So various objects in the room are linked to various moments in the game. And the game has this whole mechanism where you go into the game and you are taught that you have a certain amount of tokens with you. Helping people costs you tokens. Depending on how serious their situation is, it costs more tokens or fewer tokens. Whereas hurting people gains you tokens. Again, depending on who the person is and how badly you hurt them, it's hurting people gains you tokens. You can't kill people in this game, but you can hurt them. And in the game, at least one and possibly two random unfortunate events will happen to you. The unfortunate events include shipwreck, pirates or bandits, and getting arrested. Any of these three happening to you will not actually physically hurt you, but they will cost you between half and all of your tokens, determined by a random dice roll. And from then on, the only way you can gain tokens is by being helped. And the only people who can help you are people you helped during the first half of the game. You are not told that part up front. You are not told about the random unknown event. If you help people at your own cost during the first half of the game, you have to do it for your own reasons at your own cost. Then the game ends in a really suspenseful way, which I'll talk about later.
Okay, I'm starting to see where this is connecting with the overall dramaturgy of the play. The audience at home, that will become clearer as we go on and we explicate further. But Tamara, what is your production? What did you draw out of the fantasy production meeting hat?
Well, first of all, let me just say that I'm so intrigued by Liza's game. Second of all, I drew the live theatre and I decided to bend it a little bit. Well, it's the live theatre. I would just prefer it to be site-specific. And what I'd quite like to do with it, because it's one of those plays that we've come across that sort of has a history play, but it's kind of, we don't really sort of see much of it. So I would quite like to turn this into a site-specific play that is done in a manor garden. So you have the garden outside for some of the scenes, like the scene that I was going to, well, that I will actually pitch later on, which is the scene in front of Frescobaldi's house. In a place that looks like it could be outside of a quite expensive house, the street in Antwerp and things like that, in a garden or something similar. And the audience promenades through these places and follows the play, because one of the things that struck me with it was that it's for something that you expect to be quite focused on court life and focused on politics, it's quite intimate and focusing more on the little stories. So yes, so by sending the audience through these episodic scenes as well, in some aspects, I've wanted to recreate that intimacy, but also it's outside and it's nice and pretty and potentially inside the manor for some of it, but mostly just to give that impression of walking around and seeing the real life things rather than the big politics.
So taking the play, playing around, what happens in a live space, in a more straightforward theatrical way, as opposed to the slightly more gameplay orientated with Liza so far. Eric, as our decidee, the person who makes the decisions, any questions that you want to throw to either Tamara or Liza at this time about the what they're thinking?
I want to hear the third version as well, so I can have a more global view kind of thing.
I tried to give Alexandra more of a hint as to the things Eric was into, but sadly he didn't bite. Alexandra, where are you going with this play?
With gratitude to the host for trying to angle the situation in my favour, the medium that I'm working with is web-based. So we've already done a Zoom production as Beyond, which is available on the internet. So I want to go in a slightly different direction. I feel as though the episodic nature of this play would suit itself very well to an episodic medium, to, say, a web series. And I also feel as though what we need right now is travel. What everyone has starved for is this wonderful, expansive view of the rest of the world and this feeling of adventure in different and exciting places, which this play has a lot of. So what I would like is to partition the text in such a way as to essentially have, I don't know, maybe 15, maybe 20 minute episodes as we go through time, as we go through Cromwell's life, that are filmed in the wonderful places that he visits and exists in. He's in Antwerp at the Bourse, either a reconstruction or somewhere else that would stand in for that. At one point, he and Hodge are standing on the Ponte Vecchio in Florence, which is still there. So I think that my angle would be very much especially towards the beginning, focusing on the journey side of things and the pleasant, joyful adventure.
Yes, because this is a play full of joy and adventure, actually, and of course a moral. That sense of the moral is very much in play in Liza's pitch about the gameplay, about, giving people may hurt you in the short term, but maybe it'll help you in the long term. That's why I got out of Liza's game mechanic there. Okay, we'll go on to our next question then, relatively briefly. Who are the characters? Are there any characters that you'd like to focus on in your production? You don't have to name too many. You can even go to any fantasy castings if you like, and how they may affect your mechanics. I'll go to Tamara first. Are there any particular characters you'd like to focus on in your production or your medium?
Because I'm looking to make this very site-specific production, it will be very episodic as well. So I feel like the spotlight will differ from scene to scene in my version. So I don't think that the focus will be that specifically on anyone other than Thomas and Hodge, maybe, especially for people who like their clowns.
Yes, Hodge is a beautiful clown. He's a wonderful clown. And the only real problem with this play is the late onset loss of Hodge that occurs in the text. It's a great sadness to us all. Liza, any specific characters you'd like to flag up for your gameplay?
Well, this is interesting. So, because, again, the game can be either virtual or it can take place in real time. If it takes place in real time, one would have to hire actor leaders to lead the player through it and also to be the characters who are helped or hurt by the player. And there will be points of decision where you have to make a choice that hurts one character and helps another. So there would have to be a cast of people both presenting the story and maintaining the structure of the game. If it were virtual, of course, the sky is the limit. You can get whoever you want to voice your characters who you encounter on your journey through an enormously scaled version of Hans Holbein's The Ambassadors. If it's virtual, of course, I want people with nice voices that you want to hear. Or in some cases, unpleasant voices that you don't want to hear.
It would also grip you anyway. You're drawn in.
Yes, they reach through the screen and they grip you. Also, we have scenes set in the Netherlands. We have scenes set in Italy. So it would be nice to do an early modern play with people whose first language isn't English. Like, that would be pretty awesome. I think actors with English as a second language have trouble often getting work in early modern plays. It would also be, of course, nice to push back against the image of the past as a purely white place, which we all know is untrue. So, yes, just basically beautiful voices, of which the most alluring are not necessarily the most morally sound.
Alexandra, do you have any specific thoughts on any of the characters we have? We have all human life is here, from old Cromwell, his father. Obviously, we've mentioned his wonderful servant Hodge, but he talks to all the classes in this, and there's some pass through, like, you know, these beautiful comments, and some linger.
Yes, and that's exactly what I wanted to talk about. I think there are some really interesting episodic characters. There are some really interesting characters that are very beautifully kind of sketched out, but that only appear for a section of the play. And I think it would add value to any production to really bring those character to really not necessarily set all the focus onto them, but to create the world around Cromwell, not just through the geography, but through the people that he surrounds himself with, or is surrounded by fate. So, for example, there is the character of Frisky Ball, who is Italian and adorable and a wonderful person, and who has a whole journey of his own. There is the character of Bagot and the Bannister family, who similarly have tangential connections to Cromwell, but also a story of their own. Nearer the end, we are introduced to, or at least sort of halfway through the play, we are introduced to an entire slew of politicians around the king whom Cromwell is now serving. That's the King of England, Henry VIII. And those characters, I think, need detailed sketching so as to not just be the mass of politicians. What I would like to do for that is, yes, one is, you know, as always, unless strictly required by the script, my default is gender blind and global majority. But also in terms of the something that Liza, that you said, in terms of the ability to cast people from the places that these things are, that the early scenes are set in, so that you can cast an actual Italian as Frisky Ball and make it not an opportunity to laugh at people whose names are funny and who speak a little strangely, but actually for people to for us as the audience to really connect with him, and indeed the politicians at the end. Again, you know, historically, yes, they would all have been white men of a certain age, but we don't have to. And also, there are characters of the very lowest classes who appear, like Celia and his wife, who get names, even though they're only around for a scene. So again, there are wonderful opportunities to, I think, give opportunities to good character actors and to create a world in which we are following one person, but they are not the hero and everyone else is tangential.
Yes, there are an awful lot of people we meet, friends we meet along the way. And yes, an episodic format leaps onto that quite nicely, in the sense that, someone like Bagot is a Boo Hiss villain for a percentage of the play and then disappears, and that we never see them again. So, Eric, before we go to our first little mini break, do you have any thoughts about what's come up so far? Any questions for the room?
I was just wondering, because obviously, like, with live theatre and with games that actually happen, you know, face to face, or like, you know, interactive sort of theater anyway, you know, whatever. Because Liza mentioned the maintaining structure of the play and stuff, of the game. And I've been in situations where, you know, people break the play, or, you know, because it's a devised thing. How do you prevent that, I guess? But I guess that's obvious. I mean, this is a fantasy production, so we can do anything.
Yeah, we have, well, with a fantasy production, of course, we have a magic money tree, but we don't necessarily have magic audiences. You can't, we do have to, you know, work on the assumption that real people, some of them might be assholes. Liza, do you have any solutions for that?
Unfortunately, yes, that is the one constant in the universe of working with audiences and or the public, is that you have to have contingency plans for people who are just allergic to having a good time, or to anyone else having a good time. So in the game scenario, the player has a companion, a sidekick, and I've given this a little bit of thought, and it depends on the number of people you help and hurt. If you start on the path of helping people, Mistress Bannister becomes your sidekick. If you are on the morally neutral path and you know, help and hurt people just enough to keep the books balanced, then Hodge the clown is your sidekick. Although when the unpleasant event happens to you, you will have the opportunity, you will be offered the choice to hand over Hodge to the pirates or let him drown in the shipwreck. Or hand him over to the authorities and then flee. You only get that once, and if that happens, two unfortunate events will happen to you. If you choose the path of hurting people, Bagot becomes your sidekick, but then you get a chance to hand him over to the authorities and get all his tokens, at which point Stephen Gardner becomes your sidekick for the rest of the play.
Well, so, I'm interested, because sort of Bagot's this sort of early, very explicitly villainous figure, and then you're handing over to Stephen Gardner, whose role, you know, is ultimately against our hero, but how much
spoilers
of a villain?
Spoilers!
We did just explain the plot to them, so I think, you know, history.
Well, see, if you, I assume that a player that takes the path of hurting other characters to get tokens will be motivated by gain, as many players in games are. They're motivated by looting. Bagot is a terrible person, but he also amasses wealth at the cost of hurting other characters. So I assume that he would make a good mentor for the player on the path of gain and pain.
Excellent. I'm going to move us forward because now we're going to have a little bit of a drinks break. We're all going to take a time to have a bit of alcohol now, though depending on your choice, as we're going to go over to Sarah Blake for Cocktail Minute. Hello, Sarah.
Hello.
Hello. This is the part of the podcast where we go over to our dedicated cocktail mixer, Sarah Blake, who has prepared specially for this episode of the podcast a cocktail that is entirely associated with just one character of this play, actually. Not just the play itself as a totality, but actually one character that we're all very fond of. And Sarah is now going to tell you all about it, about this cocktail that you can drink in memory of this character. And I'll pass you over now to Sarah for Cocktail Minute.
Legal disclaimer.
We accept no liability as to how this drink affects your internal organs or views on the nature of reality.
All recipes are followed at the listener's own risk. Don't have nightmares.
Thank you very much, Rob. The character in question is, of course, Hodge. Of course it is. And I have to say, Rob actually asked me to create a cocktail called the Itching Hodge, which, from the perspective of the play, is perfect, because, you know, he does quite a lot. But it's not a particularly delicious sounding drink, is it? Let's face it, the Itching Hodge. However, the cocktail itself is delicious. And it's inspired by the fact that Hodge starts his journey in Putney. Now, I am unreliably informed by the internet that Putney in the sort of Tudor period was kind of quite a green, you know, sort of market garden area. It supplied a lot of the fruit to the palaces at Richmond and Nonsuch. So in honour of that, in honour of where he starts his journey, we begin with cherry brandy, you know, in memory of those beautiful bushels of cherries that would have been in Putney at the time. So I don't think they're there anymore, unless they're in Waitrose. Anyway, you want 25 mils of cherry brandy, and you want to add that to a cocktail shaker. And then we move with Hodge across to Italy. And we end up with amaretto. And you want 25 mils of amaretto as well. Now, what you do is you shake those two ingredients together in a cocktail shaker. And then you pour them into a champagne flute. Ooh. And you end up with something that looks like that. Now, what you want is to get another ingredient from Italy, Prosecco, and top up your glass, preferably without spilling it all over the place. And you end up with this rather lovely looking pale pink cocktail that smells of almonds and cherries. In fact, it smells, if you're in the UK, you will know what I mean. If you're anywhere else in the world, you won't have a clue. It smells like a Bakewell tart. And actually, it kind of tastes like an alcoholic drink version of a Bakewell tart too. So I think Hodge would enjoy this, itching or not. Cheers.
Soupy twist.
Hodge in a glass.
Hodge in a glass there.
Hodge in a glass. Yeah.
Hodge in a glass.
Hodge in a glass.
Hodge in a glass there.
Hodge in a glass.
Hodge in a glass. Soupy twist. That was Cocktail Minute with Sarah Blake. Soupy twist.
Hodge in a glass.
So we're now getting into a little more detail about our productions. Maybe we haven't quite got a handle on what's going on. Maybe Eric needs more information to really weigh his decision on where he wants to leap. So we've asked our pitchers to all pitch a scene, a specific scene from the play. And so, Tamara, early on in the play, what scene are you pitching? Where are you going from?
Well, as I mentioned earlier on, I looked at the scene that is Act 1, Scene 3, which is in front of Frescobald's house.
Right, so we've, for those who don't know the play too well, we've met Cromwell. He's gone off journeying, and Act 1, Scene 3 is, as I say, focusing very much on Frescobald, Baggot, and the Bannisters. So, Tamara, tell us more. You have 3 minutes.
No pressure. The reason why I picked this scene is because I wanted to kind of paint more of a picture of how I see the promenade style, site-specific production working. Now, one of the things that I didn't say earlier on in the pitch, but I will say for this scene so that we can draw more of a picture, is I would actually use full period costume just to start with. And like I said, the way I specifically picture this scene is I can only go by houses that I know, and near where I grew up was a place called Petworth House. And Petworth House has a lovely garden. It also has all these little doors that you can go into. Actually, they're massive doors. It's a manor. One of these doorways would be where I would place this scene, and I would literally present it as if this was Frescobald's house, and this is where, you know, you go into that house. And in front of it, that's where Baggot awaits the audience as they walk up. They're probably accompanied by somebody dressed like a servant who kind of guides them around the site-specific area. So they would walk up and Baggot awaits them, and Baggot does his little soliloquy, which is the framing device for this scene. And he does the little soliloquy about, I hope this day is fatal unto some, and pretty much explains what he's going to do. And then the other characters come in, and we have the scene play out in what I picture to be quite naturalistic, even though obviously the actors will have to project for all audience members to pick up on it. If we want to make sure that it's accessible, I think it would be nice if the servant, who is also the guide, would be able to do sign language. So therefore, anyone can follow the scene as it goes along. And that would be quite a nice device that works within the site-specific sort of framework. So yes, I picture it as the actors playing the scene as if it was very natural, as if it was happening. And the audience is sort of clustered somewhere with the guide, but obviously they are free to kind of stand around them and watch the actors as they do their thing. So when Mistress Bannister is begging Master Friskable and pity my husband's case and all of those things, you know, that is with literally the audience standing around them. Very hard to not draw this, but, you know, you picture the scene playing out in a cluster of the characters, and then you've got the audience sort of standing at a half circle, half moon type fashion.
Excellent. And yeah. that's your scene from early in the play. Getting a sense of what may or may not be happening with in a promenade context. Alexandra, what middle episode, I suppose we should be saying, are you going to be dealing with?
Well, as a complete episode, once he's returned to London, Cromwell has a very swift rise. And I've selected a scene that is indeed in the play just a scene as a section of this episode. It is Act 4, Scene 1.
Mm-hmm.
In the way that the play itself is structured, and of course, for our purposes, we will probably edit this quite significantly, but even in the way that the play is structured, everything happens very, very quickly, and there clearly is passage of time within the scene itself. So it almost sets itself up for montage. And this the play does a lot. The scene that we're looking at comes in the structure of the play right after a choric speech that succeeds a scene in which Cromwell has just ascended to being Cardinal Wolsey's right-hand man. Then the chorus says, but anyway, Wolsey's dead now. And then we are in this scene where the noblemen around the king, who also work, have been, you know, the nearest to the king, along with Wolsey, are now placing Cromwell in a position of potential danger about some papers that he's written. And the scene goes from that, from him being potentially accusable of treason, not only exonerating himself of that, but then being showered with titles and gifts by the king through a number of people who come in and just offer him these various titles, endow him with these various titles. So to do this in our episodic kind of web series format, I think this is a good example of a technique that I think we'd want to be using throughout, which is one, to introduce characters and aspects of the plot line without adding text significantly earlier on, which I'll talk about in a moment, and two, to use the medium in order to indicate the passage of time so that we are not only skipping time between episodes. You know, in the last episode, he'd just ascended to being Wolsey's right-hand man. But in this episode, Wolsey's dead. Time has passed. Let's move on. The sequence of honours and sort of good things that are just being thrown at Cromwell being done as a montage, we would get the bits of text in between, but we would also see that he is, you know, working closer and closer with the king, that he is doing a lot of work that is, to our eyes, warranting his promotion. And we also see the comments that the other characters are making about his perilous ascent in this kind of pinpoint fashion, as opposed to what seems to be happening on stage where everybody's huddled together and muttering. The introducing people ahead is something that I wanted to touch on really quickly. In this scene, everyone involved are characters that we've previously encountered, but it includes people like the Earl of Bedford, for example, whom we haven't seen since Cromwell saved him from the Bononians, according to the script, in Bologna. He was trapped in Bologna. So the Earl of Bedford in Bologna is mentioned as having been the person for whom Cromwell's father was working as a farrier. So if we introduce that aspect from the very beginning, from the earliest scenes where Hodge and a fellow workers for Cromwell's father are seen to be shoeing the horses of the Earl of Bologna, for example, then his occurrence in the middle is not that shocking, or Cromwell's intention to save him. And his return now, well, I say in the middle, sort of a quarter of the way through, and now in the middle, his return and his willingness to help Cromwell is again warranted by the fact we know there's been that previous connection. And I think that's something that we can do with a lot of other characters.
Lovely. And now a scene from towards the end of the play. Liza, having risen high, how do we see? I assume it's going to be something vaguely fall-based. How does a game close this? I'm suspecting you can't pitch an ending. You're going to have to pitch many endings many scenes.
This is the thing. I mean, we who've seen this play, read this play, read Wolf Hall, read the history, we all know how Cromwell's trajectory ends. But in a game, you can't always kill the player. Ending a game in a satisfactory way is a real challenge for a game writer. So what I'm going to say is the scene I'm notionally going over is Act 5, Scene 5, the final scene. Which is quite long. It starts with Cromwell in the tower. It ends, spoilers, with the execution. What I'm going to say is towards the end of the play, where your character, either through helping people or through hurting people, has attained prosperity, whether or not you've attained wealth is a whole other question, but you are offered a letter by one of the characters you have helped. And the cost of the letter is all your tokens. And it also happens at a time of the play where you have about a million, a time of the game where you have about a million other things to accomplish and wrap up. The letter is one thing, and that's a single yes or a no. You don't get a second chance on the letter. You either fork over all your tokens and have it on your person, or you don't. The second thing that can help once you do get arrested, and no matter what happens, the player does get arrested through the machinations of Gardner and the various people they have hurt, because you can't get through the game helping or hurting everyone. There are always choices to be made. So you get arrested, and all of the people you have helped will try and advocate for your release. If you took 3/4 or more of the available opportunities to help people, then they will get you out of being executed. If you don't have 3/4 or more of the available opportunities to help people, but you do have the letter, you can still get out of being executed because the letter warned you about it. You lose your post at court, you have no tokens, you are poor, but you get to retire to a farm and live out the rest of your life in peace. If you used more than half of the opportunities to help people and you don't have the letter, but you're not at the 3/4 threshold, you get executed, but you're remembered well. And if you are more than 50% at hurting people and becoming wealthy, you cannot buy your way out of death. You lose all your tokens anyway on being arrested, and history will remember you, but it won't remember you fondly.
Indeed. Eric, we're most of the way through now, these pitches. Hopefully you're getting a sense of what these different productions are going to be like. Any questions, thoughts? Are you leaning? Torment someone, please.
I was trying to torment all of them, but I mean, that's just me. I'm starting to sweat because of the pressure here. I don't know. It's so difficult to choose, though. In my head, obviously, they're all perfect and, you know, wonderful. And yeah, it's just kind of like, how do you choose? Why do you have to choose one?
Because we have a prodigious magic money tree, but it's fickle. It only grows in very specific soil. Come on, Eric. Yeah, you must be leaning in somebody's direction.
Well, see, the thing is, like, I can see that, like, both Alexandra and Tamara are going, I wonder what Liza's game's like. But then, other things are kind of, you know, theater is kind of cool also. So
we're going to take another little break now, because as has been mentioned, we not only have we done some initial read-throughs of this play where we stopped and started and we discussed it, we also did a second look where we did a full run at it with pace and a little bit of prep. All of these are available on the YouTube channel. But what we can't share on the YouTube channel is the chat. Because when we're doing these relatively light-hearted readings, we have a chance to comment on the textual issues in the chat. And it gets quite intellectual and quite heavy in the chat. And we don't publish these things because it's possibly just a little too much for anyone to take. So what we've done is we've very heavily edited down the chat, and I'm going to ask everyone to switch on their microphones and prepare to deliver this heavy burden now as we enter the chat room. Enter the chat room.
We are all Tom.
Even the women.
I will never get over Bowser. Lol.
3 cheers for nice people.
Ooh.
I cannot breathe for laughing.
We're just getting to like Woolsey and he snuffs it.
Ooh.
Turnip all round.
Always clear your interest.
Come dine with me.
Cromwell. Killed by boring petitioners.
Ooh.
And that was the chat room. And now we're going into our final series of questions there, all relatively quick and snappy, as it were. Any questions about how you might rehearse or produce this? Are there any scriptural changes that you're likely to make? We've already had hints with Alexandra's take that maybe there's some moving around or hinting at where characters are, where they're not technically in the text, but also any cuts or changes. Maybe Liza has to improvise or devise material to go around the text to make the gameplay function. And Tamara, of course, promenade. Are there things in the text that do or do not work for you? So I'll go to Liza first.
Well, with the game format, the sort of game slash art installation slash real-time game, the question is, how much of the script can I keep? And, you know, being the nerd that I am, I want to keep as much as I can. Most of Cromwell's lines, they either have to go, or there have to be points where the player is alone and the next bit is being set up, where Cromwell's lines are played over some sort of audio format as maybe their inner monologue, possibly. But I don't know how that would work. The only thing, with a game of any kind, there have to be characters that you fall in love with. Not necessarily in romantic love, but there have to be characters that you enjoy spending time with that keep you coming back to the game. I want the sidekick characters. I want Hodge and Mistress Bannister and Gardner, you know, to all have very, very identifiable voices. So that involves keeping a lot of their lines. And Hodge in particular, you would keep a lot of you'd keep the good jokes. Friskyball, I think everyone falls in love with Friskyball. Whether you help or hurt Friskyball, their reactions are going to be great. What made us love the text? I want to be able to preserve that about the text. And what made us love the various characters? I want to preserve that.
Preserving the love. Alexandra.
One thing that I think would be very interesting is how the time, for my production, how time is addressed, as in the time period as well as the passage of time. I've talked about the passage of time. Period-wise, you could set this in costume and in kind of really detailed historical-looking environments, or you could lean on the fact that many of those places are still around and set it in a contemporary context. So one thing that I think would be very interesting is giving the impression of contemporaneity through partly how this is dressed and how this is kind of presented, and partly through the hints that are given, such as the king is always off stage. We never actually see this great power that Cromwell is working for. As I said, you know, the architecture is still there. You could very well be robbed and standing on the Ponte Vecchio now. And so I think for that, if you went in that direction, the script might need some more adapting and some more adjusting. But also I think there's a lot that could be made to work with the script simply through the montage aspect of the process. Us seeing a lot more than we hear. On the subject of things we hear, there is a chorus that occasionally narrates what happens to Cromwell, which would possibly be either a voiceover or a sort of documentary style external point of view. And we also have Bagot speaking to the camera, or well, to the audience, which again would either lend itself in a modern context to something more approaching a video blog or a video diary. So yes, I think that's what I'm finding interesting at the moment, is that you could go very far in one direction or the other and the text would support it.
Tamara, in the promenade theatre world, I expect a rehearsal process may not be a dynamically exciting question, but maybe script changes are for promenade. Are there things there?
Well, yeah, I mean, the rehearsal process would depend on whether it's a tour of places or whether it's site-specific, as in we're doing it at the one site and that is it. Because otherwise you would need to adapt to the different locations, which is easily done. However, with regards to script changes, again, not so much changes, but we've talked about the chorus briefly, and like I said, I would quite like to have a guide guiding the audience who is also capable of BSL, so that it's accessible, and I would have that person be the chorus as well. So I would try and, if we have to, I haven't seen, when I skimmed over the play again to prep for this, I haven't seen anything that completely clashes with the idea that that person is the chorus. I don't think it would need any adjustments for now. But yeah, so I would integrate the chorus in that way, which is completely new for me, because I'm the type of person to cut the chorus.
Yeah, I'd have to say that there's an element of just maybe with some slight reworking, is that it should be Hodge or someone similar, that you know, a character that ends up, and that we can add more Hodginess to it and add more Hodge to the end as well. So it's an ongoing.
I mean,
Hodge-ness.
That is a great idea, to have him sort of come out of the play and be the audience's guide and then interact with the scenes anyway. I mean, that'd be great. I love that idea, actually. Yes, I'm stealing that, Rob. Thank you.
Okay, that was part of Tamara's pitch. It had nothing to do with me, Eric. The pitch is all that counts. Doesn't matter whose idea it was. So now it's the final free-for-all. Do jump in whenever you like for any favourite lines, any favourite speeches, any favourite scenes, characters. It's a free-for-all. We're also interested in elevator pitches, anything you'd put on a poster, or for that matter, in a cheesy trailer. In Antwerp, no one can hear you scream.
I have been Thomas'd.
Haven't we all? I've been Thomas'd. Have you been Thomas'd? Who else has been? Who else has favourite lines? You must have favourite lines. Other elevator pitches that you want to, or quotes, or favourite scenes, just your favourite things. We all love Frisky Ball. I love Frisky Ball. Isn't Frisky Ball?
I love Frisky Ball, and I think my favourite Frisky Ball line is, "I never made my brain a calendar of any good I did." That is, Frisky Ball, rather ironically, because it goes against my game mechanism, but Frisky Ball doesn't keep track of who he helped. And he doesn't think of it as a debt, and he doesn't think of it as transactional. We should all listen to Frisky Ball, basically. And I should point out that it's not just a funny name, it's an adaptation of Italian Frescobaldi.
Yes, remember, this is based on history, and even though this is very loosely based on it, these things did happen. And these encounters are not entirely made up. I particularly like Hodge when he's feeling, when he's dressed up as a nobleman Bedford for a cunning comedy scene of escapes and japes. Having dressed up as a nobleman, oh, how I feel honour come creeping on.
One line that I like, but I only like it because it works very well in my production, on the latter end of all his journeys before he's about to go and meet his executioner, Cromwell, having visited all the places, refers to the land of worms which dying men discover. So it sort of rounds it out as an adventure still.
Yeah, and it... It's really cool because, like, Worms is a real place, and but it's also a metaphorical place.
Like Nanjing, yes.
Mm. So, any last attempts to convince Eric? Very briefly, in one line, Alexandra, what can you say to make Eric choose you?
Oh, I have two things to say. One is, I think that the loss of Hodge partway through, if done on purpose and with intention, can be a very strong emotional moment. And again, you don't have to do that with words. You can have montage. What my production is all about is this wonderful adventure over space and this journey through a person's lifetime at incredible speed, over very short digestible episodes in an easily accessible format.
Liza, you're in the elevator. It's between the first and second floor. That's all the time you've got. Come on, convince Eric.
Well, first of all, I'd say all three of our ideas have merit, and I have to give tons of credit to my distinguished co-panelists here.
Liza is far too nice for this format. I'm just saying this now.
I'm also saying, don't you want to play a game?
Ooh, yeah, there we've got the poster strap line already. Tamara, you did sort of get this a bit in earlier, but one last chance. What can you say to Eric to convince him? Because he's going to have to decide now.
I suggest to you a play that is promenade, accessible, intimate, and you get guided around the play by Hodge himself.
Yeah, you get more Hodge. We all get more Hodge. Eric, you are in the driving seat now. Your decision will decide which play. So, Eric, who are you going with?
Wait, are we doing the whole, like, sort of actual funding? Or because, like, I mean, I know that this is a fantasy production meeting, but, you know, yeah.
Yeah, it's all coming from your bank account. It's fine. We'll just sell all your worldly possessions and things. It's fine.
You were going to lose them at some point anyway.
Yeah.
See, the thing is, I was very tempted to go for Alexandra's and for for, like, a live theater thing because I like theater. I'm a theater geek. But I think I'm going to go with the game because I'm just so curious to see how it works. But also, I'm realizing that Liza won last time. So that's not really fair.
Is that your final, or are you tantalizing and you're about to leap another direction? Because, you know, you can do what you like. You're in the chair.
Well, see, the thing is, I would probably just, like, fund my own version of, like, all these things put together.
But which of us are you mortgaging your house for?
It's not my house. It's fine.
Mortgage someone else's. That's fine.
Yeah.
What's a little fraud between friends?
Well, that's what, yeah.
So is that your final answer? You're going with Liza?
Yeah, but I do like how, like, for example, Tamara's version, because it kind of, you know, it sort of forces you to confront the situation of, you know, don't give me that look. It forces you to confront the situation. It kind of makes the audience complicit, which kind of gives you something to take away. I mean, obviously, games are fun, which is, you know, yeah, we've established that. And but I guess both versions make sort of the audience complicit, which is quite something I like. You know, it makes you feel guilty when you're walking home, gives you something to think about. And it kind of, like, it's like the thing we were debating about, like, Jane Shore, like, when we were talking about how you would produce a play featuring Jane Shore. Would you have her in the audience? Would you make it immersive? So on and so forth. And, yeah, it just, I like making people feel, well, not feel guilty. That's the wrong thing. But it kind of, I like sort of challenging work in that way. As for a web series, I'm pretty sure there is a version of this, but I also know that there's probably, like, a Twine game that is around somewhere. Twine is, like, a sort of virtual. Alexandra is looking very perplexed.
I'm 85 on the inside. I need to understand these things. Explain.
Twine is a piece of, is an application people use to build text-based adventure games, right, Eric?
Yeah. Yeah. There are other things also, like, you know, choice script and other types of script, which, where, you know, you can play them on the, it's fun, mostly, if it's a good game. And if you use a text-based game, then you kind of don't really have to change much of the script.
This is true.
Although I do like the montage.
We all love a montage, don't we? The music plays and we go through the various rooms in the court. And at this point, we will ourselves go into a montage of ourselves as we close the file on this particular fantasy production. If you're interested in seeing more from us doing Thomas Cromwell, not necessarily these productions, but certainly more work on them. We've done a certain amount of starting on this point, but now we've got to the point where we could really do with some money. So there will be links to various ways you could contribute to additional work, workshops, additional artwork, additional things based on this text in the future. And those links are all in the show notes. All that remains is to thank all these wonderful people for joining us in the fantasy production meeting. With your sound on, because this is a podcast. Say goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.